As always, subscribe and click the notification bell on our YouTube channel. Be active on our Facebook group, East Coast Distressed Note Investing, and be sure to go to our website for all your note investing tools, resources, and available assets. If you have any questions, email us at tradedesk@jkpholdings.com.
Welcome back to another Real Estate Note Show. I'm your host, Dave Putz from JKP Holdings. And today we're going to be talking about if we started over in notes, what we learned, what we would do brand new. Before we get there, as always, my host, Nathan Turner. How are you?
I'm doing great.
It's a good time of the year. The sun is shining. Things are happening outside more. And we got a big event coming up before we get into our topic at hand, because I think a lot of new investors and experienced investors, we'd like to hear you guys chime in today about what you've learned along the way. We have a big event coming up that I encourage everyone to get to. It's not mine, it's Nathan's. Can you share a little bit about that before we get started today?
Yeah, man, we are so pumped. We are 3 weeks away today, 3 weeks out. So this is the Diversified Mortgage Expo. It's where everybody comes, anybody who's in notes or wants to be in notes, anything about, man, go check the website. But we've got anything from talking about creating notes, how to make them profitable when you're going to sell them, or just compliant, if nothing else. We're talking about market conditions. We're talking about how to raise capital. We're talking about...
And biggest thing is networking.
Everything. Yeah.
On top of all that, networking, which in this business is key to everything, which will, I'm sure,
yeah, networking. Topic. Yeah. And we've said it so many times, and it's still true. This is all about relationships, this whole business. So it really matters who you know and who knows you. So that's a big deal. We've got a lot of fun things too planned. You know, I was actually just, we're putting together a poster. I'll post it next week, but I don't know if you even knew this, Dave. Did you know this year we're giving away a cruise?
What? Yeah. No, I did not.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We're giving away a cruise. We have a Daytona racing game where you like sit side by side so we can get a champion racer. We've got all kinds of like fun things added into this because it matters. As you do fun things together, you get to know each other, and we do business with people we know, like, and trust.
Yeah.
So the whole conference, my whole idea for this is to bring people together so that you can get to know and like each other and start to trust each other so that you can do business. That's what we want to accomplish, is people doing deals.
Yeah, I think people miss that out, right? Of what's really going on. And, you know, besides the awesome cruise idea, I think the fact that just getting together with each other, even experienced people, this is experience meeting newbies, and vice versa. And everyone has a value to add to everything we do. And I think people lose out on that, in that, you know, COVID kind of gave us this idea of hiding behind our desk and being, you know, introverts a little bit, but networking was always the key to growing in anything you do.
Yeah.
It's huge. So definitely, I put the link in the chat. If you need it, reach out to us, send us an email, hit us on social media. We'll give you some links to the stuff. Get down there. It's down in Nashville. It's awesome. The 2-day speaking event, but get there Thursday. So just in case you want to network, and there's an axe throwing event, all that good stuff. But just get down there and just shake hands and meet with people. There's going to be a ton of information. It's a must go to event. And it's not thousands of dollars, guys. Just get down.
Yeah. And on that note, so you posted your link over in the chat there. Make sure you use Dave's link, because you can save $100 on your ticket. So might as well save some money, use Dave's link, and get yourself there. We're so pumped. Can't wait. It's coming up in just a few short weeks.
Yeah. That's awesome. So when we talk about this stuff, we want to make sure that people get what we're doing, right? And this space is all about networking and getting part of each other.
Yeah.
But what we realize in doing what we're doing, we're realizing that when we first started, we didn't know what we knew. And, you know, thinking back to now Nathan's been in since 2008, I've been in 2010, and it's a different market today than it was just 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And what we've learned along the way has been crucial. But what we wanted to do, and this started in January 2023, was we wanted to learn the other side of the origination world. So they also start in a different way than note buyers start, right? The calculations, the networking is all different, right? Because if you go to a note buying thing, you're not going to learn about note creation. You're going to learn about buying notes and the calculations and figuring things out. So what we thought about today, to add into all the stuff we're going on, buying notes and all stuff, is somebody that's been doing creation of notes This is a guy, part of our private call as well, is that done notes on a regular basis, ongoing, right? And these are the people you want to connect with, note buyers that you can buy notes from on a regular basis. So it's crucial.
Except for Casey, he's being very, very stingy, not selling any of his notes. Come on, man.
Yeah, let's bring him in. Let's bring him in. Hey, how are you, man?
Doing well, doing well. Thanks. I'm excited to be here and chat about it. And you're right, Nathan. I love holding them. I love the notes too much to get rid of them. It's my babies.
I get that. No, I totally get that. And that's my goal, you know, that's what I'm working on now is building up. I'm 47 this year. I'm not that old, but you know what? 5 years from now, I can be retired. That's what I'm working towards right now is building up that note portfolio and, you know, retired, but building up that note portfolio. So I've got monthly income that covers anything and everything that I need. So I get it. I understand why you don't want to sell, but you know, seriously.
And that's
So
what
let's
notes
jump
can
into
do.
this.
Go ahead.
Casey, how did you get started in real estate note investing? Did you come out of the womb having a house in your name and you start renting it out? How'd you get started in this space?
Had five when I came out of the womb. No, when I first got started, I actually wasn't doing notes. I was doing more traditional flips, and I probably flipped about 200 something houses before I had somebody teach me the better ways of doing notes and how valuable they can be. And you know, hindsight's 2020. I look back at a lot of houses that I flipped, like, man, had I just made that house a note, I could still be getting money on it. And I only made, you know, 10, 15K flipping that house. I wasn't a great deal, but I'd have made so much more if I held a note out of that bad boy. But yeah, no, I started off flipping and I did that for quite some time, mostly around the North Texas area, and learned a lot. I do think it was really helpful in my progression of knowledge to have a wide breadth of knowledge of what real estate can be. Once I learned about how notes work and how to kind of really want to hold assets, not just sell them all. And that's, you know, why notes are so powerful for me. And I started learning about it. I started doing slowly. You know, I would still do a flip or two and hold a note or two, do a flip or two, hold three or four notes, and kind of just building up the note portfolio and learning the process as I moved and transitioned only, you know, into notes. And now at this point, we solely do notes. We'll originate probably about 80 to 90 new notes this year and just keep holding them. Accidentally, occasionally we'll make a rental, but 95% of what we do is notes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Cool. Interesting.
Did you learn a lot of this stuff through going to masterminds, classes, RIAs? Where did you get most of your experience and knowledge to get started?
All the above. I couldn't agree with you more earlier that your network is your net worth, right? And meeting with people and going to masterminds and going to a variety of different groups and just being a sponge of knowledge and information. One thing I've always learned is, you know, ask all the questions. You know, I want to be the guy there. I remember going on the first masterminds I went to about notes, and my hand was up constantly asking every question I could come up with. And one of the other attendees actually ended up complaining to the host that I was asking too much. Well, fast forward to today, he texts me weekly asking me questions on how to do things. So,
Wow.
you know, full circle. But yeah, I definitely go to events, go ask questions. And I'll tell you, we all get excited and passionate. We love to talk about it. So
Yeah.
you're not annoying somebody by asking them a question. Like we get excited, goosebumps just talking about it, you know. Let us go
Is
share our
weird.
knowledge, you know.
It is definitely weird that, you know, you go to a lot of other sectors, people are hush hush and don't want to share. You know, we'll talk for hours about the same topic over and over again. Our wives are tired of it, you know, that kind of thought process.
100%, 100%. Yeah, and it's partially because I feel like there's somewhat of a bad stigma around notes if you don't do it right. But if you learn how to do it right, and if you learn how to benefit you, to benefit your end buyer, your borrower, and all the different parties, it is such a phenomenal scenario, and it is such a great opportunity for all parties. And that's one of the reasons I love talking about it, to make sure that it is done right, and to make sure we're not putting somebody in a bad spot, and they benefit for years to come.
Well, and
So
you know,
wait.
a couple of weeks ago, how long ago was that? Maybe a month, maybe 2 months ago, we had Kevin Shortell on here, and he was talking about, you know, notes as a strategy for real estate investors. And like just having that in your tool belt, just having the knowledge of how notes work and how you can do different things with notes. Say you've got something that's tough to sell on the market, you look at it and you're like, I'm only gonna make $10,000 off the flip. What if I did a note? What would that look like? Just as an option, if nothing else,
Yeah.
just to expand your knowledge and your different, you know, array of things that you can do with a property. So it's worth
Yeah.
knowing.
100%. I mean, it should be another arrow in your quiver, right? Another way that you can
Definitely.
go at the problem and solve it. And I wish I had a lot of properties looking back. I wish I had understood how they work and what they are. And to be honest, I felt kind of intimidated by them at first and overwhelmed. And like, I got to walk before I crawl. And you somewhat do, but like, they're not that complicated. And once you keep diving and keep learning and keep focusing on it.
Yeah. I think we also get embarrassed of what we don't know, right? That's one of the big things we run into is that I don't want to ask a stupid question because then I don't look experienced. And as you get experienced, you actually feel more comfortable asking questions because you're like, crap, I don't know it. I need to know it. And I think you are kind of fearful of asking a question. And what you'll find if you're a new investor in the space, ask the questions. We all like jump over who could answer first, right? That's our methodology because we know we love to teach. It's just, you know, we don't want to be guru teachers, but we love to, if someone has a question, we love to help. And that's kind of the bread and butter of what we do. We help homeowners.
We do. And it's also fun now that having become kind of a mentor and teaching other people and how to originate them, I often get asked a question I can tell people are timid. And I can't count the number of times that I've rethought my process to that individual situation and proved how we do things because I was asked a question that made me rethink. Yeah,
we learned.
Like, hey, you know what? I'm glad you asked me. I learned in talking about it. Yeah. You know, it's phenomenal.
So when you first got started, what would you say your first big mistake was? And we'll go around the table here. What was your first big mistake when you got started in notes in the creation?
Ooh, can I come second?
what would you give up two or three? Give me one of them that popped off your head. Like, crap, this was a big thing. I didn't realize, didn't know, didn't understand that, you know, that I think people, you know, we just, in the beginning, we don't know. But then it's like, crap, if I would have learned this earlier, it would have been easier. The sobbing that if I knew it now, what would I do differently? And I'll jump in here real quick and say, I didn't understand yield. I didn't understand the whole financial calculation part of it. And that, you know, when we first started, the rule of thumb was buy a percentage of UPB and BPO, which at the pricing, it didn't matter what the hell you did back then, right? It was a home run. I didn't understand that to probably 2014, 2015, when things started to get a little tighter, that I had to understand all those numbers, that it wasn't a flat, quick equation. Hmm. And I'm like, oh, this what the interest rate matters. It does matter. Mm-hmm. And that was a big thing for me. Casey, what do you
got a few. What do you got, Casey?
Well, and I think that actually is really good because I mentioned I look back at properties and I wish I had made notes because I didn't understand how to use a 10B2 calculator and figure out a way a note works. And then once I got their price, you know, okay, great. I know what my PI coming in is, but what is my cash on cash return? And not understanding really what that formula even does. And it's really simple once you've done it 20 times. Yeah. But knowing that that's our focus, I focus on cash on cash. And having learned that, you know, if I'd known that earlier, there are deals that I did flip or that I wholesaled or that I just even passed on in general, because I didn't, that house is, they're waiting too much for it. I don't know how to make that a deal. And what I should have done is gone to my network and gone to my friend and say, hey, look, this one, I don't see a lot of equity. I can't really flip it. I'm just going to turn it down. Should I do that? And they'll say, you know what? You could, you know, seller finance with them, or all the ways I can acquire it differently before I wrap it and resell it. So, I think the knowledge is very important there.
Man, Nathan, what you got?
I got a few. But so going back, I was creating notes in 2009, 2010, and 11. And a little bit in 12, but like that's kind of how I got started, was creating notes. At the very beginning, the thing that I think was probably one of the biggest mistakes is understanding the paperwork and just knowing what a proper note looked like.
Oh, and okay.
We're doing contracts for deed in Ohio. They're called land contracts. I was doing land contracts in Ohio. So, and we just pulled something off the internet, I think, which was okay, but not really great. So, and I didn't really understand what it was, and it worked out anyway, but it would have been good if I had a better understanding of that paperwork and understanding how to get it together. I mean, and then other things like some of those first properties we seller finance, I didn't get enough of a down payment. So it was a relatively small down payment. We would do like, we kind of backed into it. So we said like, if the local rent is $500, we'll charge you $400 a month. You can own this house for less than rent, was kind of our tagline, me and Corey back in the day. And it was, I think we took, basically treat it like a rental. So it was like first and last month's rent was your deposit. So it was two months worth of payment was the down payment. That was not nearly enough
to have,
you know, qualified borrowers, and then just learning how to qualify the borrowers. I mean, there's a few different things. So I guess education is a big deal. Make sure that you get educated on that. Make sure you understand some of those things, because you can make it up and you can maybe be okay, but wouldn't it be nice to know how to do it properly the first time?
And one thing to piggyback on that, I mean, I look back at some deals that maybe I even though I found the deal, maybe I go give it to my experienced partner to let them run it so I can go see their paperwork.
Yeah,
because paperwork is so important. You know, even if I don't have to reinvent the wheel and learning, you know, getting someone else's paperwork and going through it. And then sitting down with them and saying, hey, can you just walk me through this? Like, what is this deed of trust? Like, what, who are the parties involved and how does it work? And I'm also, we only do Texas. So I'm very focused in Texas. So every state does have different rules and laws. And that is something else that you guys both deal a lot with. Does that change how you manage buy and your learning process has to be steep?
Yeah, because we're doing it nationwide, right? In the beginning, I was doing flat timeframes, flat this, flat that, and didn't realize that Texas is different from Indiana and different from Ohio. Timeframes, costs, expenses. And then the one big mistake I made 2011 or so, I literally went and bought a note, foreclosed on it, and totally forgot that there's back, that the A, it was back taxes, and B, I figured 1 year tax, that's it. It took 18 months. So it extra on top of the 1 year wasn't part of my equation, right? So I learned the fact that I actually had to look at the delinquent taxes because that was due at the auction. That was paid first. I knew taxes are paid first, but it was like $5,800. I'm like, oh, I'll take $5,800 out. It was 13 grand. I'm like, whoa, what happened there? It was almost triple. And I realized that, oh, crap, there was back taxes plus 18 months of tax, not 1 year. And each state, each county is different, right? Timeframes change. And I didn't understand BK, you know, that would delay stuff. And then it was like, you know, at the auction date, what do you mean it's not going to foreclose today?
I did. I remember
legal stuff.
Yeah, I remember doing a cash for keys and I didn't check title first. So I didn't realize there was another lien on there that still applied that I then had to pay. So that hurt, you know.
Just learn real quick, how does that affect people that, who don't know why not just do a deed in lieu and get cash for keys and if there's no lien on there?
Yeah. So I, you know, somebody's living in the house, they are willing to just take a payment to leave. So I pay them whatever it was, $1,000 or whatever. They agree to just leave instead of going through a whole foreclosure and eviction. It's a really great way to go, except that I didn't check title to see, I forget what the lien was. There's an additional lien that then fell to me. And I don't remember the amounts or anything like that. This was years ago, but the lesson learned was check title, because that will tell you if there's something else outstanding that, because they just gave the house to me, we didn't go through a foreclosure that would have wiped out some of these liens. That's the big one right there, right?
If you have another lien, it's not a problem, but you have to foreclose on it.
Right.
Right. And get rid of that second lien or whatever lien. In Florida, you can separate it and, you know, foreclose on it, take it back. But you can actually do deed in lieu to yourself and still foreclose and wipe it out. But yeah, it's crazy.
I had a couple that purchased, and the wife had unfortunately passed away, but we did a cash for keys for him to get the house back. But she, we never cleared her off title. We didn't realize until later when we were going to resell that we created kind of a pickle because we didn't pull title and didn't know the process. I should have asked more questions of other people.
Right. Yeah.
And so let's talk about when you first got in, what kind of due diligence did you know, house due diligence or property or borrower, what kind of due diligence do you know now that in the beginning you messed up on and it may have affected a deal, may have affected a profit? Was there something you do now that you didn't do when you first started that you wish you knew if you started over today?
Yeah. I mean, there are two sides for us, right? It's how we buy the property. Cause we buy the property, we take title and then we resell it out to a new homestead buyer. And so their due diligence on both sides of that equation are paramount. Cause when we're buying the home, you know, understanding all the liens, all of the debts, all of the situation of what's going on, getting a clear title can be complicated. I had one 3 weeks ago that had 26 heirs and two of them were in prison that we had to get to purchase. So it gets complicated, and knowing how to solve those was tricky. I think for us now, we mostly buy subject to, or a combination of subject to and seller financing if they have equity. I would say the biggest thing that I've learned on that side of the fence is that I don't want to be a motivated buyer.
Okay.
If the deal works, then I'll work it, but I'm not going to be motivated to where I'll overpay or I'll force a situation that really I know I shouldn't do, but I just want that house for emotional or whatever reason. I've done that where I bought a property that I knew it needed more work, but I could probably do it. I was going to force it, and that ended up just killing my cash on cash in my return. And I've definitely learned that side. On the flip side, when finding our homestead buyer, Nathan said it, not doing the right underwriting of the DT of their DTI, knowing who is getting into this home, because it is a long-term relationship with them. And not doing that underwriting correctly and not knowing what I didn't know on what to look for at expenses that they had and what other debt they were, you know, into their DTI to go through it. We do a soft kind of underwriting before we go through our RMLO now, just to filter mm-hmm. out a waste of time type thing. And knowing how to do that process efficiently is really, really helpful. And what's one something now that my VAs do is they go through and do that soft underwriting for our buyers. But we have a very defined set of criteria of what we collect and how we go through that. So we don't make those mistakes. But yeah, making sure that it's the right buyer. Same thing. I don't want to be a motivated seller. You know, I buy yep. from motivated sellers and I sell to motivated buyers. I don't want to be the opposite on either side.
Yes.
You know?
Right.
And then that knowing how to not let my emotion affect that decision. I want to get this house sold. And that's another thing. I feel like I used to get nervous. I've had this house on the market for 2 weeks and I haven't sold it. Oh my God. Right. And I'm willing to take a lower down payment or I'm willing to, you know, do a little bit less. You know what? Hold yeah. the line. Just hold the line for the right buyer and do it because they're out there. You just got to find them and do the right marketing to find them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Man, nailed it. And it's, you know, it's interesting going, you start talking to note buyers and or note creators, anybody in notes, you start talking about where they came from. Yeah, we made all kinds of mistakes. And luckily we've made it through that and we've figured it out. But I don't know, you know, on the one hand, realize we're not superhuman.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We went through the mistakes just like everybody else. The other thing is, man, some education would sure be nice. So you can skip some of those things. And you know, Dave's got a program and yeah. there's lots of other ways you can learn the business, but it's worth paying a little bit of money up front just to understand what you're getting into and how to.
Yeah, I think that was going to be my next thing is when I first got started, I didn't pay for education. I was working at a fund, had some great people around me. They were buying yeah. tons of stuff. I didn't pay for education because I didn't think I needed it. And when I, back to what we started before, one of the big things I missed out in that paying for education is the network of other investors who were part of it that I can go to. I had to break into sectors like Nathan and stuff like that because who's this guy coming in? There was only a couple of trainers out there. Who's this guy coming in? Where does he know? And I didn't become part of that, you know, formation of networking. For housing, you know, one of the things I learned was, you know, when we look at houses is we need someone eyes on the ground, right? You need someone to experience, look at stuff. I remember looking at Google Photos. And one of the classic stories I had was, we looked at Google Photos and we're driving down the road and we just happened to call an agent, they're local, and just drive by and the house was gone. Happened to be the Google Photos. We then turned the corner mm-hmm. and the front view was the house there. When we turned the corner, it was a newer photo and turned around and the house was demolished.
We were probably looking at the same one.
Oh yeah, that's in Florida, too. Right? Like, holy goodness.
Mine's Ohio, so that was a different one, but same situation.
So it's where- like,
wow.
This picture, and then you go around the corner and it's an updated picture and there's nothing there.
Yeah.
It was a Universal Studios prop wall.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So wow. let's move to, you know, going to owning the asset. What did you do in the beginning when you owned the asset that today you'd say, crap, I wouldn't do it again, right? Is it your processes? Is how you maintain? When you have one or two notes, it's pretty easy to kind of maintain stuff. What would you do what you did before over again? And if so, what was it? Or what would you do differently?
Yeah. I'll address that. Let me go back to your thing on that real quick too, because I do think the education and training is paramount, but one of the benefits of a network is that when you are in a pickle situation, because they happen to everybody, you have someone to turn to. It's not just the initial underwriting. I have a note from 3 years ago and I'm running into this scenario, and having mm-hmm. experienced people to turn to at any stage of the process is really invaluable, because we've all made mistakes that have cost us thousands of thousands, and learn from my mistakes. Don't go do them yourself.
Yeah.
But you know, as I mentioned, when I got started, I was slowly getting into notes because I was still a lot of flipping. And so I would buy some, you know, some properties, turn them into notes. I'd hold one or two and I would learn a little bit as I was doing it. I like that approach because I had the pops of cash from doing some flips to keep things going. And that was helpful. I have a lot of wholesale friends that have tried doing the same thing, do a couple of wholesales and then, you know, hold a note here and there. And I think that's a nice way because you can kind of learn a little bit when doing it. And that was helpful for me. I also, I'm sure you both have, you know, the Invest in Debt by Jimmy Napier.
Yep.
One of my books I've read twice and I don't like to read. I'm the type that listens to an audiobook, buys the hard book and puts it in the shelf to say that I read it. So yeah, I actually read that one. But yeah. I made my whole team read it. My whole company has read it to be on that board. But yeah, difference in small notes, you know, have definitely brought a lot more things in-house that I used to outsource. So I also own a loan servicing company that I don't manage day to day, but I own it. And so it lets me help with improving processes on maintaining our borrowers.
So if you start all over again, would you do what your system was when you started again?
Yeah, I would. I would definitely still slowly get in doing a couple because I was also originating them. So I wasn't just, buying the notes. So I was also doing marketing directly to sellers already because I came from the flipping world into this model. I would do it that way. If I was coming not from the flipping world, then because flipping is not something I encourage people to do, to be honest. It's high risk, especially in a volatile market. If you do it right, it can be phenomenal. But yeah, since I came from that world, I think it was good to slowly kind of move in that direction. And I enjoyed that. I also, a lot of things I like to do, like loan servicing. I used to work with a completely third-party loan servicer. And I think that was good because I saw what they did. I learned this. I liked some of it. I didn't like others. I thought I could improve it. When I got to about, 15, 20 notes, we brought it in-house. And I think RAI stands for Reimagine an Expense as Income. And I brought over the servicing side. And so it's under our preview. But now, we do things when we're selling a property, we help them file their homestead exemption because I want them to get their taxes as low. We just did a campaign to all of our borrowers about protesting their property taxes to keep their taxes low because I want their TI as low as possible. So they always pay that. And another thing that I think I've learned along the way that doesn't directly answer your question though, but is I want to be a friendly lender. I want to be super nice to our borrowers. But there's a point when I'm not helping them by allowing them perpetually get further behind. And I used to feel like I was doing them a favor by letting them, they'd get a payment plan and they would break it a month in, but we'd do it again. And all of a sudden you're multiple months behind. And when someone gets 2 or 3 months, but 4 months behind, they're not going to get a current. You're really just making them in a worse spot.
Right.
And so and a lot of times we have the mantra of it's a lot of times like, children that you're trying to help them do what's best for themselves. And so we do payment plans, but you get one a year. And if you break it, it's back into the foreclosure process. I mean, we do that because it's no reason to just keep kicking the can and make it worse for themselves. So I think it's at tough love has actually been helpful because since we started doing that, we have fewer deficiencies and fewer people behind because we are on top of it. And we don't get out of sight, out of mind, but it's also easy. Some of them, another thing that we've done is we allow our borrowers to pay weekly. Some of them, they can't manage monthly. So you get a check on Friday, they make a payment on Friday, things like that. So that they don't get behind because it's constantly ACHing from their account.
Cool.
That's good. That's good. I've been guilty of that too, where I'm trying to give them second chances, third chances, fourth chances, and I'm not helping. And it seems like, I'm trying to be nice. I'm trying to be friendly. I'm trying to be helpful, but same. I kind of came to that realization. In fact, I remember talking with a friend of mine years ago and, I said, I hate being that guy that is, going to foreclose on him and whatever. And even then I rarely foreclose on a person. It's just an empty house, but he said, no, you're thinking about it wrong. He says, the way to think about it is you're holding them to something they've already agreed to. That's it. Yep. So they've already agreed to these terms. You're just holding them to it. I'm like, yeah, no, that's exactly right.
They're making the choice. There was agreement. If this happened, then this happened. If this happened, then that happened, right?
And I can help as much as I can. But
when you first started, Nathan, those systems you have in place now, maintaining the assets, what'd you do in the beginning? Would you do the same thing over again? And what do you do now?
I mean, in the beginning, it was a spreadsheet. I did that too long, where I was up to around 50 notes and I was a spreadsheet and it was like color coded. So like yellow was something I had to watch and make sure I was on top of. Red was something I had to do today. Green was fine. I didn't have to think about it for a while. That's a terrible system. Like it was fine for the first dozen notes or so, but that gets out of hand very quickly. So there's actually a friend of ours, Adam Adams. He's the one that hooked me up with Pipedrive and helped me set it up. And that's why I still use that today. And even with different businesses. So going from the non-performing model to now a performing fund model, I still use it to keep notes on everything, keep me, just on top of all the different notes, just to make sure nothing falls through the cracks. So I waited too long to get into that. I would say, like you said, Casey, after 10, 20 max, look at some kind of software, whether it's Pipedrive, Salesforce, I don't know, whatever, anything.
But I'm a nerd. I live in Salesforce. I subscribe to the nerd hat. But I agree with you though. And I do think it's important to have some system, but that system will evolve over time. Your spreadsheet works definitely for a while, and don't overcomplicate it.
Right.
You know, if you just got a few, do what works for you. You're going to naturally start to see things that you want to do differently, better ways you want to track it.
You get stuck listen, I need something better than this. Yeah, right. I totally agree.
Yeah, well, you'll see something broke in the process and you need to improve the process. And I think that's something that we've spent probably the last 18 months to 2 years is really focusing on processes and systems for all aspects. Everything needs a process to it. But they're refined and they're always getting tweaked. You're never done. That's part of owning a business. You're always overcoming the next hurdle, you know? And that's part of the fun, but don't let those hurdles be too intimidating and scary. You can overcome them. They do get a guide, a mentor, a helper to do it, but they've been overcome by people not as smart as you, you know?
For me, you know, I was allowing services and servicers and attorneys kind of send me multiple emails. And I got lost because I didn't know what happened before, until the point where I said, listen, I can't do this. We have 15 emails about the same subject because they create a new one. Mm-hmm. I need that thread where I can read back and go, okay, what happened here or there?
Yep.
And even with PipeDrive, if they send an email, it's another thread in your email thread. It's like, I need just that one thread of details and make sure they put the note number or the borrower name or some kind of respect that don't just send me an email like, hey, update here. And it just doesn't work because update mean to what asset, right? I would think that when you first begin is what I would do if I did it over is really kind of make sure my services, all of them, our way that works for me the best and say, listen, if you're going to send me an email, please email me on this thread and make sure you include the loan number or whatever number works for you and kind of keep that in order. I agree with you guys. Start with the spreadsheet. Organize stuff. Get things done manually so you understand it. So when you want to hand it off to somebody as an assistant or a VA or using the AI, as we talked about the other day, you need to understand the manual processes and understand when things go bad so you know what to fix. You may never need to fix it. So don't go out and buy Salesforce or PipeDrive if you may never own more than 5 or 6 or 10 notes. Mm-hmm. Just be simple in the beginning.
Yeah,
absolutely. So in that process. And for me, working with these attorneys, and there's a lot of people they come into play. Even with performing notes, you deal with some stuff. There's a lot of people in play. Just have some way to know who is involved in this asset at all times. If you want to use a spreadsheet, that's fine. PipeDrive has context. To know who you should reach out to. Who is the servicer, you know, contact person there? Who is this person, that person? So when you need to reach out to somebody, you have a contact and you're not searching their emails. That's something I did at the beginning that wasn't that good. I was just hunting for stuff.
Yeah,
I think that organization, you have your own process and your process has to work for you. It's funny you said that. Last week, we do a team training within the business and I was actually training an organization of a couple things. And I came to realize this is how I like it organized, but that might not actually be best for this other team. Sure. So the objective needs to be the same, but as long as you're on top of it and organized, have a system that works for you and it will grow and scale as your needs grow. But don't overcomplicate it and do too much too quick.
And there's actually a lot that I use now through Google. So like Google Calendar, I'm using it way more now than I was 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Stuff gets on there.
You know, when you use the technologies around you, right, your email, your calendar, things get easier and simpler for you just because you're not realizing everything you have to manage is on point. Da, da, da. You know, make a to-do list every morning, right? And say, okay, I do this and kind of manage your time. The calendar is a simple tool that you all have on your phone, your thing. Have it set up and start blocking out periods of time in your day for certain tasks. Right. If you're going to check assets, Nathan has a great strategy. He has certain days for certain things. I'm going to review things on this Wednesday and block it out because I'm going to tell you in the beginning, I wouldn't look at something for 2 or 3 weeks because I just forgot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like crap, the email came through and I never went back and followed up on it. So that struggle was that. I'd like to hear from those in the crowd. I know we have a bunch of Twitter, Facebook and stuff. Again, this will be live streamed on YouTube and podcast. We'd love to hear back from the crowd. Like, what kind of things did you learn in the process? And if you're a beginner, what questions do you have that we may be able to answer? Thinking back to when we were first beginning of what we would have done differently, or maybe, you know, today's world, we're just maybe because we've done enough, we do it differently now, but we wouldn't have done in the beginning. Like Salesforce, I would never recommend anyone or PipeDrive to go out and go grow that thing in that system.
No, don't start with it. Yeah, make sure you understand how you work first. What's the process that works well for you? And then find a software that can back that up.
Yeah. So yeah. The next part is, you know, when we exit a deal, it's often not what we thought when we first bought the note, right? Or created a note. I'd like to hear some stories about your first problem that you, when you finalize a deal, what went wrong or what would you do differently now that would have prepared you better for that? Or maybe something you would have put in place to protect you, which you do now. What did you do in the beginning that you did would do better now that maybe your first two or three deals, something went at the end of it and you're like, crap, that REO or that performing note or, you know, structuring a JV deal even. Like, what would you do differently now if you restarted today? Casey, what are your thoughts?
Well, again, I want to go back to one thing you said a second ago to that. You mentioned having a good system. My wife always asks me in the morning, hey, what are you doing tomorrow? I don't know. It's on my calendar. Like I intentionally don't try to remember a lot of things. I have a process to remind me.
Yes.
Because I don't need to internalize it. I'll drop it. If my whole team knows if they want to meet with me, it's got to be on my calendar. Otherwise, it's just not going to happen. Same thing with my day-to-day tasks and calls and things. It's all in my CRM. I don't know who I'm calling that morning when I get to my desk. It's in my system.
Yep. Yeah.
And my thing that I joke with, if people ask a question, is it in Salesforce? Because then we know. Otherwise, it's not happening.
Yep.
So have a process. So totally agree. You know, two things that, you know, exiting deals, you know, we hold our notes. We don't really sell them. I guess we do get some back when we have to go through foreclosure. I had one recently where we didn't do the paperwork right initially because we only looked at the
paperwork
of the deed of trust and the note. Both were standard, but they weren't as comprehensive as needed. And we had to foreclose. And when the borrower moved out, ended up leaving two RVs and a mobile home on property. But we didn't have personal property listed in our deed of trust. So we couldn't dispose of them. We couldn't get rid of them. And it took me a while going through a court system with our attorney to be able to get those through the DMV, moved over, and et cetera, et cetera. That slowed down my ability to flip that back into a new note and get these things off my plate. And so again, and looking back, I wish I had, instead of trying to come up with my own paperwork, gone to some people into a network to get those, get some of those things. But yeah, most of ours, again, my disposition on them is the getting into a note. So I would definitely say correct underwriting of having the right buyers is so important. Oh, another thing that I would say, I've had some people that are in my shoes that when they're selling them, they'll go and let their borrower even finance their down payment over a short period of time or do something super creative to help them get into the home. And that only bites everybody in the keister later. That's not a good answer because they can't afford it. And, you know, I know you think you're helping them again. I've had friends do that, you know, in a pickle later. So yeah, I definitely knowing who is in the home and waiting till you have a right borrower for us, because we're originating them.
Yeah.
You know,
because you send people up for failure, totally. Right? And it just causes more headaches later. And you rush to do it because I got to get this house sold. They want to buy. Let's go for it. And at the end of the day, you have to resell it anyway. You have to foreclose on them and the whole process. And you're kicking someone out of their house. It just doesn't feel good. You know?
No.
We wouldn't do it with our children. Why are you doing it with borrowers?
Yeah. And you mentioned that point too on how it feels bad having to foreclose on them. But, you know, I have had a borrower that we had to do that on, I'd say about 2 years ago. And then I talked with her about a year afterwards. And she said, you know, I was really in a house I couldn't afford. I thought I could. Life went crazy. And you actually forced my hand. And I'm so amazed at this conversation. But you forced my hand to go and move into somewhere where I was saving money. And she moved back with family temporarily, got a clean start and moved on. And I'm like, you know, I think of that now in that had we just kept kicking the can, should have had a bigger, you know, foreclosure of an immediate or inevitable anyways. So letting us just do it earlier, that was one of the epiphanies for us that, you know, we'll do payment plans. We're going to be flexible. But if you don't do your terms and you don't agree to it, you know, we have to move on.
Yeah, true. Yeah. So Nathan, what have you learned when you finish a deal and you say, man, I should have done this, I should have done that. Or, you know, what could you have done better in the beginning that you know now?
Those first few deals where we were trying to resell them, like I say, if our paperwork was just not right. It wasn't correct. And so that was a big stumbling block trying to sell those first couple of notes. It's just, and I think, you know, partially we didn't know what we were doing. Partially we were trying to be creative. We were doing things like you said, Casey, like the down payment, they couldn't afford a lump sum of it. So, okay, that's fine. Your first 6 months of payments will be this much. And then after six months of this, we'll count that towards your down payment. Cool stuff, very creative, but ultimately not helpful. So that was the biggest challenge right off the top, excuse me, was just making sure that paperwork was correct for that back end, and something I hadn't even thought of, nothing I would have considered before I was creating those notes.
Yeah.
And we're running into that today where people are creating notes and now they're trying to sell them. And we're going, oh man, this paperwork is a mess. It's not that it's not sellable necessarily, but you're probably not going to like my price.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I am going to have to discount it because I'm going to have to take some time and energy and legal resources to go and fix that.
Yeah.
And another one that I think I learned when originating them is that we used to try to really get as much as we could from this person, the borrower. And you know, if they have 15 total in their checking account, we were trying to get the 15 is down. Mm-hmm. And that's not good for them and it's not good for us. And we really do, and we tell our borrowers that our goal is not to drain all the money that you have available, because A, moving is expensive.
Yep.
And all their setups and getting utilities and all that stuff. And we used to have a year ago, new notes would always have a dip and they'd start off a little bit behind and they'd end up getting current. Shocker. Because they were unexpectedly having more costs in the moving or new furniture or whatever. So now we're like, you know what? We'll go ahead and take 2,500, 3,000, whatever it is, a little bit less on a down. I want mm-hmm. you to not be late when the mortgage starts yeah. in 2 months. I want you to have money in your pocket because I want this to be a long-term friendship and not trying to be taking it. You know, that doesn't help anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you got? For me, you know, when we took back a property and learned REO stuff, I didn't realize how big an importance of the area was for me, right? I was looking at tapes and saying, that number looks good. And I didn't realize, like, the area of the property was a key thing, right? We bought in properties, the areas that looked good, but I didn't really understand the area, right? A lot of us were in Columbus, Ohio when we first started. That was a big, big area for no buyers, whatever happened. But there were different sections of Ohio that's more attractive where, yeah, the value of the property is good here, but if you get over here, it's even better. So sometimes you pay up for certain areas. We had some properties where we then couldn't sell it because it was in the bad area. And even though it was, you know, it is what it is, I just didn't learn. But I also had the flip side. We bought a property in New Jersey, Trenton, where it was on three streets that were the highest value of the entire city. We just happened to get lucky. But I realized the fact that start diving in and understand the local area was a key thing for us, because there are plus and minuses of every area, even if it's in the same city. And it's really interesting. We've seen pictures also where the front of the house looks beautiful and the back half is gone. Like the whole house is gone. And not really getting a foot on the ground and seeing the property is essential in understanding the process. It's crazy what you don't realize. So how do you do that, Dave?
How do you get that local knowledge without being local?
Right. So there's a couple of different ways. When you first got the notes, the biggest question a lot of people say is, well, I don't want to buy outside my local neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then my reverse question is, would you be, you know, if someone came to you and asked you about your local neighborhood, would you be able to tell them? Absolutely. So what I started doing is I started networking with those people who are either A, a note buyer, or B, people who help me normally. So I'd go back to the person who helped me sell an REO and say, hey, what do you know about this property over here? And they had a wealth of information. There are local REO agents who can do the rekeying, the winterization, the trash out. They knew their local market much better than any of us would do it, right? I think for me, I learned to use my network that I already built of REO agents to say, hey, listen, would you buy this property? And the answer is, well, yes or no. And then go, why? And they say, well, you don't understand. This is happening over here. There's a huge thing, industrial problem going on. I'd be careful with this. And I started learning about this stuff, and they can go locally and check out things. And sometimes they even knew the house. We're like, oh man, watch out for that problem. Right. Mm-hmm. We looked at a house one time, someone died in. We didn't realize there was a murder scene, right? We just didn't put two and two together.
Yeah,
and you're like, oh, really? Yeah. And you have a ton of local note investors who you could reach out to across the country, most of the time in different counties, and say, hey, can you just do a drive-by or let me know the local area? You're more than likely easy. Get on the phone and ask questions. They'll take 5 minutes and just say, yes, great area, bad area. This is the value. It's really awesome. So
a sneak peek. A little sneak peek coming up later this summer. We've got a special guest coming on where she's going to talk about the network that we can tap into together. Yeah. So I'll leave it at that, but it's a huge network nationwide, very valuable. We're excited to have her come on here in a couple of months.
Bernard mentioned on the Zoom, on the Facebook feed, I think that he set up Zoom calls with people to see local properties. That's awesome.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. Absolutely.
One of the things I love about what you said is that when you ask if they would buy it or not, you followed it up with why. And one of the things we do a lot on our team is ask all the questions you can possibly come up with. Keep asking questions. There's always more to learn. We buy anywhere in Texas. And so we buy in the tiniest of town. But one thing I've come to learn over time is I have to account for that in my hold time. To find my end buyer, I've got to buy it better so that I can account for a longer hold. But we use a service like WeGoLook, but WeGoLook.com works in some areas and some it doesn't. We now have handy people in different regions, but yeah, you definitely have to know the region. I bought one down by the coast that I thought was an awesome little property. And I was super excited. It took me, I don't even remember, 5-6 months to find a buyer because it was a small town that had 3 people.
Wow. Yeah.
But they all did know who used to live there. They knew the whole backstory. So it's funny. I definitely see that. Another thing, and again, I do a lot when I'm buying them. I've learned a lot about septics and well waters and stuff like that has been a bit of a pickle a few times.
Yeah.
I sold one and we buy sight unseen frequently. We're physically seeing it. We get a lot of photos and we're going to resell it. And we actually sold it. And then the borrower calls back and say, hey, we had our water tested and it's just not good. And we our seller we bought it from lied and misled us. And that was my fault for not doing the due diligence. Yeah, he can lie and do whatever, but I'm the one accountable. So we had to fix that process now, but we had a $30,000 hiccup that we had to go put a filter on that because it's apparently as well in this part of Amarillo is just dangerous. And I can't let someone live in a house that it's got unhealthy water. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Learned a big lesson that one. And so I should have gone to others that have done properties in that area and said, hey, what do I not know about buying in the rural parts around the city? But now I know.
Yeah.
So the next question I have for you guys is what was something you learned that you could never prevented and you just didn't know, even if you put everything in place, you just didn't know, right? You wouldn't have been able to solve it. Maybe you can never solve it, but what would be something you know, I have one kind of mind that, you know, it was something that I learned along the way. There was nothing I could do about it. It sucked, right? And I have a situation where it did come up. I now have something in place to prevent it, but, you know, because a lot of times people are afraid of what can happen and they're afraid of what they don't know. But sometimes you can't solve that problem and there's nothing you can do. Do you have a scenario, Casey, that you ran into that even today you don't have an answer for that you just said, crap, I can't prevent that mistake from happening and to learn from it?
I mean, we have a lot of mistakes. I mean, I think when we do go and have to get a house back and it's been into a very bad shape, is something I really can't prevent.
Yep.
And nothing I can really do about them. It's part of the game. That has bitten a little bit a couple of times, but not super common. I usually get rentals in worse shape back than I do.
Yeah.
But so it's not a common one, but I do think that most problems we've been able to mitigate the risk, but you know, as much as we can. I can't think of a good example.
Sure. Well, we can go back in it, right? Nathan, do you have a scenario that I have one in my mind that we both have, we probably not even thinking about is, you know, we never can predict what a note's going to do.
Yeah.
A performing note, a non-performing note. We buy a note that's performing and it defaults, right? And then we can't control that. We can't control a note and what happens. If I bought a great note that I think is going to perform forever and it stops performing, I have no control over that. And there's nothing I can put in place to hold that to be true. All I can do is calculate, making sure my offer takes care of all those scenarios.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then I was thinking, I totally agree. And that's, people are weird. I've been surprised at, you know, the direction it goes where that doesn't make any sense. And there's no reason it should go that way, but that's the decision of the borrower.
It's so, people.
Hey,
you know, you're foreclosing with equity.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, the house is, you know, owed 50 grand. It's worth 100. Why am I foreclosing it? Why aren't they selling it?
And
sometimes we don't get it.
No,
right. And like Casey said, sometimes the housing condition we can't control and we can't get inside to look at it.
Yeah.
Right.
And that was the one I was thinking of, is especially on a non-performing note. I don't know. You know, there's a very high chance that I'm going to take that property back on a non-performing vacant property. That's very likely this scenario. And I can do my best guess of what the inside looks like based on the outside conditions, but I don't know. I don't know for sure. And we can get in that house and all of a sudden there's all these problems that we just could not have foreseen. We can make some guesses and some fairly educated guesses, but we can't know for sure until we get that back.
The story that came to mind for me in Vernon, Texas, which is a small little town. I got a house. One of the first ones I did, I got the house back. We did a cash for keys and deed in lieu. He didn't want anything to do with it. We go out there and to find out there was about a 3.5-foot hole in this roof that had been raining on, how long that had been open. It just caused all kind of molds and damages throughout the house that wasn't expected. Luckily, we bought that one right. As you said a minute ago, we bought it very right. And we actually turned around and resold that as is, but at like 25% value to someone he's a rehabber. He wants to live in it and he's going to fix it himself. I'm like, awesome. Go for it, buddy. Mm-hmm. But we're able to find a creative solution to that problem without pouring a bunch of money in it, but definitely an issue.
And so we usually find some workaround. Sometimes you can't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Casey, what was your worst deal? And if you could start over again, what would you do differently, if anything, to prevent it from going bad?
It's the worst deal I had. It was not a note, but, and I'll say that what I could have done to prevent it is, you know, trust but verify. And I took someone at their word that they were going to cash pay for a property and we were going to close outside of title. Again, I thought I was doing a friendly favor. I thought I was doing the right thing to help someone out. And he was lying left and right. And unfortunately that has now tainted my ability to just blindly trust. And now I didn't have it papered. I kind of had the old handshake trust theory and it literally went through court. We're looking at text messages to prove my case. Like it was a problem on about a $1.3 million house. Oh. And yeah, it was an ordeal. But I didn't have it papered and correctly. And I think that what I should, obviously should have not just taken his word, but I think something you said a minute ago too, I think anybody who's been doing real estate long enough has had bad deals. You've had bad deals. And I think that had I heard my story before getting started, I might've been scared, but don't be scared. Don't let that be intimidating. And I'm glad that didn't scare me away because we could learn and improved and did better, but bad deals are going to come apart. It's a part of the learning. Have people you can turn to and a network to learn from, but it's part of the process. I don't care if you're flipping or wholesale, you're going to have bad deals and it shouldn't be deterring.
You're going to have more bad deals in your business, right? It's not, just changes.
Right.
So Nathan, we've talked about this monthly, you know, what would you have done differently in one of your quote unquote bad deals that prevented it from being bad?
I got one that's still not done. I talked about this one a little bit, still not done. This one in Chicago that I got where, first of all, Chicago, that's the problem. Yeah. And just Chicago is just a very difficult place to work in for all kinds of reasons on every level, honestly. And so, yeah, the mistake was I finished a foreclosure. The only reason I bought the note is because it was already in foreclosure. It was about to complete. So I'm like, good. It'll be, you know, fast, easy deal. Very predictable. I know where it's going until we got a squatter. And that was right as COVID was starting. And then she just very much took advantage of that. Actually, 2 weeks ago, last week, my attorney sent me a clip that she had posted on Instagram where the judge was actually kind of going off and she just took a little recording of it. And it was good because he didn't talk about the names or addresses or anything like that. So it's okay. Yeah. He was just going off and talking about how this lady's a professional squatter and, you know, on and on and on and on. It's pretty funny that, you know, the judge is up to here with it. And you can imagine how we all feel. But anyway, the judge is like, this is ridiculous. Still not done. And she's still not out. We actually had a court case, I think it's today, where this should be the nail in the coffin. This should be the end of it. But she's very successfully dragging it on. And like literally beginning of COVID. So she's been there three years. Hasn't ever paid a dime and still not done. So how would I change that? It goes back to the trust but verify, like Casey said.
Don't buy Chicago.
don't buy Chicago, but it all started because she expressed interest in buying the house and said that she would go in and start doing some work on the house. Why did I say yes to that? She was not a licensed anything. And you know, that was my big mistake is just saying, yeah, okay, go for it.
So my worst mistake, and then we'll get to Nathan's last question is, you know, my worst mistake, we've mentioned our worst mistakes on the show, and I'm going to bring up a different one. There's a deal in Miamisburg, if Tim's on, right? Back in 2011 that I didn't trust my gut saying buy it, and it ended up being a killer deal, right? It was a deal that because I just didn't, my gut says buy it, and I just got scared. And it was, we were newer, 2010, 2011, 2013, somewhere in there. It was just, we got scared, and we shouldn't have been scared. We should have said, okay, the numbers look good. We bounced off a few other people and everyone said, yeah, great deal, go for it. And we got nervous and didn't buy it. And it was a killer deal. We should have bought it. And it was just the fact that we didn't trust our network and our numbers saying this is a good deal. And it goes back to the fact that, you know, if you have a good deal, you can bounce it off of other people and say, what do you guys think of this? And if multiple people say it looks good, go for it.
So was it because the numbers were too big, or you just didn't have experience with that? Or
it was experience, and it was a bigger note. I think the house is, it was a note was like 60. It was a bigger note for beginners, but it was like 250 value. And it's like, is it this? It was too good to be true kind of scenario. And it was, we were getting sold directly by the person who owned it. And it was like a one situation. So no one else saw it. And I just didn't go for, I don't know why. And we look back and go, man, I forget all the numbers, but it's like, we should have went for it. And it was just the fact that we didn't trust ourselves and the people we talked to. It's like, this is a great deal. Go for it. And it was just nervous, because when you're first beginning, you're nervous about everything because you just don't know what you don't know. So I hope this episode here, guys, helps you guys learn a little bit about the problems that we face and what we would do differently if we start brand new in the space and go through it. I think it's been really helpful just sharing the different perspectives, as well as Casey's idea from origination side, right? He didn't know but arm below and things like that. But the education gives you that knowledge and your network. For us, it's learning about different scenarios, because one of the things you learn is, just because you are in the space, your deals are always different from everyone else's. So you may do 100 deals and never see one situation. It just happens. So that's why your network is huge, to hear about their stories, learn from their perspectives and things like that. So go ahead, Nathan Lee, take it away.
All right, Casey, this is the crystal ball question. So we want to know, so you've done this for a little while now, and now you've kind of got your processes now and everything else.
This isn't whiteout. This is real.
What do you see coming down the pipe, especially on the origination side where you're at in Texas? Is it increasing, decreasing? And what do you expect to see?
Phenomenal question. I definitely was reading the other day about, you know, the supply being increased here in Texas more and more, the builders adding more and more homes. So my reselling of homes, I had a little longer hold time. I like the interest rates are higher. It's easier for me to sell at my rates when bank rates are higher. So I'm happy about that. I'm still taking over a lot of homes that are COVID or prior type loans. And so, you know, it really allows me to take over a low interest, which is great. I see that continuing. I think, you know, that the hold times are going to probably keep creeping up a little bit, but they're not going to get out of control here in Texas. We have a pretty good demand across the board. Prices, you know, Abbott increased the amount that we can do on property taxes not long ago. And so that's helping bring down some people's PITI, which is helpful for our borrowers. And right now we're moving into the summer, which is a phenomenal time. So, you know, we've bought 5 houses this week, and we've been buying incredibly fast. And I think it's easier for me to buy than sell, always, at least quicker. Mm-hmm. I can contract and be closed in 10 days to buy a house, but it usually takes me about 45 days to sell traditionally. It just depends. So I do think that we focus more on a little bit bigger cities than we have in the past. So we do have a little bit lower hold times, because hold time is what kills me, because I'm paying marketing, I'm paying holding costs and mortgages, et cetera. Yeah. So yeah. I care a lot about the hold time. And I do think that we are also going to be a little bit lower on some of our interest rates when we're reselling them, because I do feel like the economy is slowing a little bit for some people, having a harder time handling some of their mortgages. So we're willing to set it. We typically, if it's under 200, we're at a 9.99 when we resell. We may come down to a 9.5, which, you know, it doesn't sound like a big deal, but it kind of is.
Yeah.
And I think we'll be more quick to do that than we had in the past. We won't start off there, but, you know, if it's not moving at a month, month and a half, I may start be looking at my interest rate, just because I do want to move through them and not try to get all the, you know, water out of the cheese or whatever that old saying is.
Yeah. Are you using agents to find their borrowers, or are you finding them?
No, we do all of our own marketing to find our own buyers ourselves. We don't use agents to buy or sell. We use a lot of Facebook. I spend almost much on Facebook because I do Google ads to find our end buyers. And we use a couple other, you know, sites to get them out there. But yeah, we do our own direct marketing to sell to buyers.
That's awesome. Awesome. Good deal. Well, Casey, cool. I know people have your connection. I'm sure you'll get emails from people asking questions about, you know, your experience, your knowledge. Those who are originating and whatnot. Casey, a lot of the knowledge, we've known him for about a year or so now, plus he's been part of our private group and all that stuff. So it's awesome to have that experience and knowledge and just the insight of what it's like to begin, right? We all started from somewhere, and it's hard to begin. It's really difficult. But once you get breakthrough, it's a joy to be part of it. Well, Casey, I thank you very much for holding on for after hours for us for a few minutes. For everyone else, we will see you soon. We'll be on before. We're going to do a call before DME. If not, we'll see you down at DME. So